Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today, talking about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Today, we're going to explore in depth the idea that we can get healthier, happier, if we understand that we do not live in a sustainable future. Now, that may seem a lot, but I'll explain it in depth and share some insights from Derek Jensen, from DerekJensen.org, on the sustainable development is a lie. And yet, most people don't stop and think, what I'm eating, where did it come from? Is it sustainable? What I'm wearing, the house I'm living in, the way I'm commuting, all the things we take for granted, that it's always sustainable. It isn't. What can be done about it? The solution? I'll share that with you. From our environmental segment today, we're going to take a look at Extinction is Forever, an interesting report from Robert J. Burroughs from Countercurrents. Also today, the failure of the American left, iron-fisted co-optation, by Professor Norman Pollack. Professor Pollack was on this program on the Progressive Commentary Hour, which is every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Chris Hedges last week, a really informed and inspirational, insightful program. He wrote a commentary about what he was listening Chris say when he was waiting to do the second part of the program. It's really insightful. I'll share that with you. But we always start with the latest on health and healing, and we have a lot to share. Let's begin from Rutgers University. They've done some good research over there showing the power of cruciferous vegetables. Where I was growing up, no one ever heard of a cruciferous vegetable. You rarely ate them unless it was in the middle of summer. Almost every vegetable that I remember growing up was from a can. All the fruits were from a can and a heavy syrup, a sugary syrup. It was only when I moved out of West Virginia and had my own farm, the Fertile Earth Farm, up in Stone Ridge, New York, near Rosendale, that I began to plant everything and just enjoyed a completely different taste, especially things were always cooked to death where I grew up. And here, just either raw or a little bit steaming, and it released the natural flavor. Well, one of the group of vegetables we're not eating enough are cruciferous. And they're important because they help prevent disease, including cancer. This is the latest from Rutgers University. Quote, cauliflower is just one of many cruciferous vegetables that may be able to treat cancer, according to this study. Now, why? Well, this audience knows that there are chemicals. And two of those chemicals, one is called thiocyanates. The other is called glucosinolates. Now, those two are sulfur-containing phytonutrients that cleanse the body of damage-free radicals. We forget that every day there's a process of mitosis, cell division. About 1.5% of our cells grow new. Now, some are really rapid, like the intestine cells, mouth cells, and skin cells. Now, other cells are much slower, but the danger is if you have damage from a chemical, from a virus, a bacteria, the body cannot easily rid of that. So just imagine that every day we take our garbage and either recycle it or dispose of it, and it goes in generally to a landfill, rarely composted, and you forget about it. But just imagine that you did not have the ability to dispose of your garbage. You had to put it in bags. How long before you couldn't live in the apartment or house because it was just filled with garbage? That's why the body also has to rid itself of damaged tissues and cells and bacteria and fibers all the time. And sulfur is the great detoxifier. Now, there's a substance called sulforaphane, and it's a compound that we now know inhibits the occurrence of some cancers and helps detoxify the body. Quote from the Rutgers research team, our research has substantiated the connection between diet and cancer prevention. It is now clear that the expression of cancer-related genes can be influenced by chemopreventive compounds in the things we eat. And that was the head of the professor of pharmaceutics in the university. By the way, even the very conservative American Cancer Society admits that more than two-thirds of cancers can be prevented with lifestyle modification, and that includes diet. And sulforaphane from broccoli, cauliflower, has been able to prevent tumors and polyps from occurring in your colon. And these are based upon very good studies. A kale, mustard is also in there. So get the cruciferous vegetables on a daily basis. Kohlrabi, turnips, watercress, Brussels sprouts. And then you'll be a lot healthier. Also, one of the best all-round natural remedies is black cumin seed oil. It is extremely powerful. Now, not everyone can take it just by drinking it. If you can, great, but more often than not, people have to dilute it. I would suggest diluting it in a smoothie, a protein smoothie, and then have that smoothie three times a day. That way you're having a third in the morning, third in the afternoon, third in the evening, and you put 2 teaspoons of black cumin seed oil in, and then buffering agents like a rice milk, banana, some vegetable protein. Therefore, it doesn't return on you. Now, what can this wonderful little tiny seed and the oil in it do? Well, according to the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, this little tiny seed, the nigella, N-I-G-E-L-L-A, sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A, commonly known as black seed, is probably the most powerful healing seed on the planet. And you can get it in anywhere from, 100 milligrams up. And in this particular case, people used it for 9 weeks, or they used a placebo. And it had substantial benefit. It showed, quote, an improvement in memory, attention, cognition. How about that? It also improved cardiac, liver, and kidney function. So, take a look at the scientific literature. Go to the U.S. National Library of Medicine, and you'll see that it has at least 20 distinct physiological actions. It is an analgesic, meaning it's a painkiller. It's antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, anti-ulcer, anti-fungal, anti-hypertensive. It's a very powerful antioxidant. It's an antispasmodic, very good for seizures. Antiviral. It's a bronchodilator for people with asthma or congestive lung conditions. It's an anti-diabetic, what is called a very powerful blood sugar stabilizer. It is a liver protector. It is hepatoprotective. It is hypotensive. It's an insulin sensitizing agent. It's an interferon inducer. That means it helps people with hepatitis B and C. And it also is a tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibitor. So if you were to take black cumin seed oil and some turmeric, ginger, red pepper, oregano, cinnamon, you will have given yourself the best you can get to help with a flu or cold, or just as a tonic. If you put that in with some lemon juice and green apple juice as a diluting agent, about 30 ounces, and drink that throughout the day, that would be terrific for you. More information about why nanotechnology can be dangerous, but in particular about aluminum. According to Natural News, the nanoized aluminum is being sprayed into the atmosphere, causing degenerative diseases, or so says a neurosurgeon. It was back in the 1960s that the scientific community began to look at climate change and how it could be manipulated. And according to Natural News, what might have turned into a productive discussion of responsible protection of the Earth's climate and ecosystem had eventually evolved into an experiment, a scientific experiment. By the 21st century, jumbo jets were being deployed to drop billions of dollars of nanoized aluminum and other particulates into the sky in attempts to reflect sunlight away from the Earth and cool climate temperature. And this science, which was an experiment, has exploited populations of people to mass amounts of airborne metals that are literally raining down and as a result having a negative impact. According to neurosurgeon Russell Blaylock, the nanoized aluminum particles found in chemtrails are contributing heavily to degenerative disease today. And like bioengineering, where scientists rewire the DNA of crops, creating genetically modified foods, geoengineering is the global attempt to manipulate the sun and Earth's climate. Now, in both mass engineering operations, so-called professionals try to play the ruler of all nature and all natural processes as if they can control this. Well, you can, and it doesn't take a genius to do it. Stop taking the coal out of the earth. Stop taking oil out of the earth. Stop taking gas out of the earth. And instead use natural, sustainable, non-polluting solar, wind, geothermal, wave. These are all legitimate and very proven resources that can keep the planet from excessive heating. What they're doing is causing the heating, and they're not stopping. They're increasing. India, after the Paris the air quality and global warming issues, said that they're doubling the amount of coal they're going to use in the next 5 years. China's already a disaster. They're killing the people over 1 million a year just with air pollution, and it's going to get worse. So that's how you get rid of the problem. You don't spray chemical nanoized particulate matter into the air expecting the sun to reflect back into the universe and away from the mountains and melt the ice. So the effects of greenhouse gases are real. But when did any group or government or billionaire gain the authority to use jets to pour massive amounts of elements of unsuspecting on unsuspecting populations? But they're doing it. So the key is, if anyone wants to have an intelligent discussion about the chemtrails, they're real. They're not a conspiratorial theory. We have all the documentation. The fact that they're trying to do it, possibly, to help lower greenhouse effects is, in my opinion, doubtful. Because once these private contracts are given to corporations, no one ever again questions, why did we give you that money? It's like the war on cancer. Or the next 10,000th walk for the cure. Did we ever cure anybody with these walks? No, but it made the people who are making the drugs, like tamoxifen, very rich. And the Susan B. Komen Foundation, very rich. Colombian doctor broker. The idea was to introduce sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere in the 80s. And by 2006, Dr. Crutzen, that's Crutzen, a Nobel laureate from the Max Planck Institute, began publishing reports on how that might work to cool the planet. And one of the main inventors of the hydrogen bomb, Edward Teller, thought that injecting sunlight scattering particles into the stratosphere appeared to be a promising approach, and he wrote about that in the Wall Street Journal. The consequences of mass spraying, according to neurosurgeon Russell Blaylock, were really bad. Degenerative disease, especially neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, are growing at an alarming rate, and he believes, in part, not all, due to the mass spraying of nanoized aluminum into the atmosphere. According to independent medical literature, nanoized particles, quote, are infinitely more reactive and induce intense inflammation in a number of tissues. Here's what Blalock says, quote, "Of special concern is the effect these nanoparticles have on the brain and spinal cord, as a growing list of neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's disease." Well, Blalock believes that aluminum nanoparticles can easily penetrate the brain through the blood-brain and olfactory nerves in the nose, passing through the olfactory neural tracts. Aluminum particles easily penetrate the area of the brain most affected by Alzheimer's disease. And furthermore, in Alzheimer's disease cases, this part of the brain is shown to contain the highest level of aluminum. Now, the aluminum particles also enter the body through the respiratory system, where they've been shown to cause tremendous inflammation in the lungs, further aggravating conditions like asthma and pulmonary disease. And due to their small size, remember they've been nanoized, the aluminum particles can even enter the gastrointestinal tract and can disperse into many other organs and tissues, including the spinal cord. So, just something to think about. Also, from Kaiser Permanente in California, they're saying that if you're using antacids because you're eating wrong, incorrect foods, a lot of those very spicy foods or very deep-fried foods, pizzas, and you end up with indigestion, so you take an antacid. Be aware, long-term antacid use is linked to vitamin B12 deficiency. Why? Because antacids are commonly used to neutralize the acid in the stomach. So you end up not having as much acid reflux. But what you end up doing is you end up destroying your B12, and that can play havoc with your energy level and your central nervous system. So we're not getting enough B12 as it is, and if you're taking antacids, you're likely to get less. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall. And by the way, for those of you who sometimes are out and about and you want to hear the show, not a difficult thing to do. You can call a telephone number, or let's say you go to your local land-based station or you go to the internet and for some reason the show is down. Not a problem. I broadcast no matter where I'm at in the world every day at noon Eastern Time. You can always hear it by telephone. Let me give you the number, write it down, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. In fact, of all the thousands and thousands of radio stations that use that service, we're number one. So we have, we're approaching 20 million minutes people listening. Huge number of people listen every day because people are out and about. It's easy for them to get you listen to the show on their portable listening device. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now, I want to share some insights. These are from Derek Jensen. And I posted this. I thought they were very important, things we don't consider. Here's what Derek Jensen has to say about sustainable development is a lie. Sustainable development is a claim to virtue. The word development used in this sense is a lie. The word develop means to grow, to progress, to become fuller, more advanced. Some synonyms are evolution, unfolding, maturation, ripeness. And some antonyms are determination, disintegration. And here is a real usage example from the dictionary. Drama reached its highest development in the plays of Shakespeare. But here's the problem. A child develops into an adult. A caterpillar develops into a butterfly. A stream harmed by, say, mining might possibly in time develop back into a healthy stream. But a meadow does not develop into white box houses. A bay does not develop into an industrial port. A forest does not develop into roads and clearings. The reality is that the meadow is destroyed to make the development. The bay is destroyed to develop it into an industrial port. The forest is destroyed when the natural resources are developed. The word kill works just as well. Think about it. You're going about your life when someone comes along who wants to make money by developing the natural resources that are your body. He's going to harvest your organs for transplantation, your bones for fertilizer, your flesh for food. You might respond, hey, I was using that heart, those lungs. The meadow, the bay, the forest, we're all using what you call natural resources. Those natural resources were keeping them alive. Those natural resources are their very body. Without them, they die, just as you would. It doesn't help to throw the word sustainable onto the front of whatever you're going to do. Exploitation is still exploitation, even if you call it sustainable exploitation. Destruction is still destruction, even if you call it sustainable destruction. One sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. We industrialized humans think we're smarter than everybody else. So I'm going to lay out a pattern and let's see if you can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think about cedar forest, so thick that sunlight never reaches the ground? That's what Iraq was like before the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture was the deforesting the hills and the valleys of what is now Iraq to build great cities. Oh, sorry, I guess the person doing it wasn't deforesting the region, he was developing the natural resources. Much of the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna until these resources were developed for export. The Near East was once heavily forested. Remember the cedars of Lebanon? They still have one on their flag. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests were destroyed. I mean, sustainably developed to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. Greece was heavily forested. Ancient Greek philosophers complained that deforestation was harming water quality. I'm sure the bureaucrats at the ancient Department of Greek Sustainable Development responded that they would need to study the problem for a few years to make sure there really is a correlation. In the Americas, whales were so abundant that breath made the air look perpetually foggy and were hazardous to shipping. Development of that resource removed that hazard. Cod were so numerous, their bodies slowed the passage of ships. Development of that resource fixed that too. There were so many passenger pigeons that their flocks darkened the sky for days at a time. Once again, development of that resource got rid of them. Do you know why there are no penguins in the northern hemisphere? There used to be. They were called great auks. A French explorer commented that there were so many on one island that every ship in France could be loaded and it would not make a dent. But that resource was developed and the last of those great creatures was killed. Developed in the 19th century. 200 species were extinct just today. And 200 will go extinct in the next 24 hours. That's correct. And the day after the day, and another day after that, every biological indicator is going in the wrong direction. And we all know why. The problems are not cognitively challenging. Development is theft and murder. Development is colonization applied to the natural world. Development is kleptocracy, a way of life based upon theft. Here's another test of your intelligence. Name any natural community or ecosystem, if you prefer mechanistic language, that has been managed for extraction, or that has been developed by which it meant industrialized, that has not been significantly harmed on its own terms. You can't, because managing for extraction is harmful, as we would all recognize, as in the example I just gave. If it happened to us, we would all recognize that if an occupying army came into your home and took your food and a couple of your relatives, that your family would suffer. So why, with all the world at stake, do we suddenly get so stupid when it comes to sustainable development? Why do we have such a hard time understanding that if you steal from or otherwise harm a natural community, that natural community will suffer harm? Upton Sinclair wrote, "It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it." I would extend that to read, "It's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends upon them not understanding it." In the 1830s, a pro-slavery philosopher argued that slavery was necessary because without it, the slave owners would not have the comforts or elegancies upon which they had become so accustomed. The same is true here. When we extend the understanding of slavery to the natural world, as this culture attempts to enslave, meaning develop, sustainably develop, more and more the living planet. In short, we're allowing the world to be killed so we can have access to ice cream 24/7. And we call it sustainable development so we can feel good about ourselves as we do it. The good news is that there are a lot of people who see through this nonsense. The bad news is that it doesn't, for the most part, affect policy. A story may help make this clear. Before the big Rio Earth Summit back in 1992, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations sent out high-level assistance across the country, ostensibly to get public input as to what should be the U.S. position at the summit. One of the meetings was in Spokane, Washington, and the hall was packed, and the line of people to speak snaked out the back of the building. Person after person testified that sustainable development was a sham and that it was just an excuse to continue killing the world. They pointed out that the problem is not humanity, but this culture, and they begged the U.S. representative to listen to and take a heed on this and lead from indigenous peoples the world over who lived well and lived truly sustainably on their lands without development. In fact, they lived well and sustainably because they never industrialized. They pointed out that development inevitably forces both indigenous people and subsistence farmers off their lands. Person after person pointed out precisely what I'm saying. When we were through giving the testimony, the representative thanked us all for our support at the U.S. position and for our support of, quote, sustainable development. Wow. It was as though he hadn't heard a word we said. Here's the problem. The word sustainable has since been co-opted to not mean helping the real world to sustain, as in playing your proper role in participating in a larger community that includes your non-human neighbors, but instead to mean sustaining this exploitive lifestyle. Think about it. What do all the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? It's simple. They all take industrial capitalism and the colonialism on which it is based as a given, and the natural world as that which must conform to industrial capitalism. This is insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. The real world must be primary, with whatever social system you're talking about being secondary and dependent. because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. Sustainable development is a scam and a claim to virtue because it's attempting to sustain this exploitive, destructive culture, not the world on which it depends. And that will never work. So in conclusion, so many indigenous people have said that the first and most important thing we must do is decolonize our hearts and minds. Part of what they've told me is that we must break our identification with this culture and identify instead with the real world, the physical world, the living earth that is our only home. So, something to think about. Now, think about the people who want to sustain their friends on Facebook. It's a fraud. Think of all the things they address that are trivia. Think of how addictive the mind becomes to the consequences of living in trivia, where your whole day is spent distracting yourself because of the boredom, the tedium, the non-real that you're forcing yourself through ritual every day to participate in. And yet, we think that we don't deserve to walk barefoot in the grass and sit with nature. That we'll get to it someday when we get rid of our real problems. No, that is the real problem. We have made all secondary issues primary, and we have not given ourselves time for our authentic self and our real needs. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We've got a lot to share, including a really interesting commentary from Norman Pollock, time permitting, and also getting vaccinated is like playing Russian roulette. Who is going to be taken down is anyone's guess. Also, which is the more accurate source, Russian television or Fox News? Who's more accurate on the truth? I'll give you a really interesting example. And then an extremely powerful understanding of the narration of contemplative mode. Sound a little tricky? Not when Alan Watt is the person guiding the journey. So that's what we still have to come. But now we have on the phone Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary.
Luann. We have a few minutes here to let people know that the next health retreat is full, and that's a good thing, but you have kept some time aside and space aside for those who may not be able to afford the full price, and it's always our policy to allow those who may be in a not the same financial position as someone who can pay the full amount to come as work study. Explain what that is, please.
Surely. It's a great opportunity for people who really want to come down. And I've had a couple of people call me, and they really are excited about coming down, but their finances just don't allow it. So we have the work-study program, and that essentially means that you're in the background helping out the staff. You're helping to keep things clean and organized, and you still get to go to some lectures. You still get to work out. It's just that you're helping us out behind the lines, and you come for a less price. So if you're in that boat, and remember, we need people with good work ethics, positive, upbeat team players. That's what we're looking for work study. So please give me a call, because this is shaping up to be just a phenomenal event, Gary, for your audience on Progressive Radio Network. And WBAI. It's going to be just a great time for everybody. What a great way to start the year, to be in a warm environment with you there, and I'll be there, and we have beautiful trainers, physical trainers, and meditation classes, and the gardens, and the animals, and the birds, and peacocks just walking all around. Like, well, you're walking around, they're walking around with you. It's just, it's going to be amazing.
I look at it from a slightly different perspective. I just see that a lot of people today are confused. They've lost touch with their authentic self. They've mastered their career. They've mastered many of their relationships. But they have not mastered their life. And because of all the chaos going on today, the uncertainty, so many people losing their jobs at all levels, not just those who are uneducated, but people who have had seniority are losing. Over 7.5 million Americans have lost high-paying jobs because their jobs have been taken by people from generally India, and who are willing to work for one-third the price. What do you do if your standard of living, you're paying mortgages, you're paying kids' tuition in college? And by the way, over $12 billion is owed by senior citizens for their student loans. And many senior citizens went back to college to re-educate themselves into another field, and now there's no jobs for them, or they co-signed on children or grandchildren's loans, not realizing before the crash that everything has changed. And the companies and the banks, the financial system, and the government is not forgiving to senior citizens. You could be 75 years old and have no income outside of a small Social Security check. They're going to garnish part of it. They're going to take whatever they can that you have. And that's where we're at. Also, a lot of people are just stressed. A lot of people, the older people, were told that the only measure of your happiness in life is the quality of the relationship you have. So they've been either holding on to relationships, trying to make them work, sometimes having good relationships, or alone and feeling desperate because they don't have a relationship. And as a result, they're living with chronic sense of insecurity, which creates stress, which prematurely ages you, hurts your heart, causes cancer, hurts your brain. Younger people, on the other hand, they weren't conditioned to believe that the merit of your position in a society is based upon a relationship. They didn't buy into that, and thank goodness they didn't. So they're able to feel good about themselves alone if need be, or having quality friendships. There's an inordinate amount of time people spend looking for Mr. or Mrs. Right instead of looking for what's right within themselves. You can't show me a person who had dysfunction in themselves who found wholeness where that dysfunction went away when they're in a relationship. All it is the burden of that dysfunction is carried by another person, not just yourself. It doesn't dissipate. And so we need to come to grips with the fact that we're living such false, non-authentic lives. We miss the idea that we work hard for the fact that we don't frequently work smart. And we're stressed. And the more stressed we become, the more we constrict our emotions, anger, rage, judgmentalism, instead of expanding through love. So my goal is not to help people enjoy a vacation. They can do that on their own. They're a wonderful place they can go and do some yoga up at, you know, in the Catskills, or they can go to South Beach and lay on the beach and party. That they do on their own. I'm only interested in people who want to change their life, realign and harmonize with what is real. So never a day do they have to wake up feeling I'm depressed, I'm anxious, my life is filled with clutter, woe is me. Or looking for someone to rescue you, or looking to rescue someone. So that's what I'm looking for. So if people who want to come know what you're able to get, this is a remarkable opportunity because based upon the schedule that I have ahead of me and all the new projects starting in this new year, I'm out on the road filming now. I'm not going to be having time to do these retreats. So if you would like to come and do work study, which means that you help in the kitchen or do some of the other chores for a part of the day, but you get to take in all kinds of wonderful lectures and you get counseling, power walking, work out in the gym, and you can save yourself some money, then call Luann. Luann, give the number, please.
Surely, it's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. Give me a call. If you get the answering machine, just leave your name and number and say you're interested in the retreat. I call everybody back within 24 hours.
And if anyone has ever listened to the testimonials about people who have attended these, those are real people who had life-challenging conditions when they came and life-affirming results when they left. What is the value of that? And there are hundreds of people who have experienced that just in the last 2 years. Thank you, Luann. Give your number one more time.
631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. Give me a call. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. And that's the last week of January. Now, who should we trust? Russian TV or Fox News? I have said all along that there was no legitimate reason to invade Gaddafi's country. None. If you look at all that Gaddafi had achieved for his people, the highest standard of living of any of the 54 countries in Africa, he had all these resources. He was sharing it with his public. He wanted to switch to gold and a special type of gold that they would mine themselves, where their currencies, their exchanges would be best based upon gold. The Americans couldn't handle that. So now listen to the truth about Gaddafi's golden oil plan and two different takes on it.
Speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And as RT's Laura Emmett reports, the organization may have been trying to prevent Gaddafi from burying the American buck.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Others say it's about oil.
The only reason they're interested with Libya is about the oil. You'd think we'd be in Iraq if the major export there was broccoli.
But some are convinced intervention in Libya is all about currency, specifically Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth.
It's one of these things that you have to plan almost in secret, because as soon as you say you're going to change over from the dollar to the something else, you're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this, one in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested. I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today, who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed, some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here in a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen. Laura Emmett, RT, London.
So once again, it wasn't about bringing democracy and freedom to Libya. Libya had no terrorists at that time. Al-Qaeda could not get a foothold into Libya, nor could ISIS or any other group. And if you were an average Libyan, you had more women in positions of power than any other country in Africa or the Middle East. You had a higher standard of living. You had free education, free health care. You were given a house. You were given a bonus. You were given a car when you got married. Take a look at it now. Now listen to what Hillary Clinton had to say in defense of her policy on Libya, and it's just pathetic. But then again, she's pandering to a pathetic group, the corporate Democrats. You just don't get any more pathetic than they are. Now, and it's an embarrassment that this person should even be considered the most powerful for the most powerful position in the world. So let's take this to a different level now. Here's some thoughts from Alan Watts.
Why is it that we don't seem to be able to adjust ourselves to the physical environment without destroying it? Why is it that in a way this culture represents in a unique fashion the law of diminishing returns, that our success is a failure? That we are building up, in other words, an enormous technological civilization which seems to promise the fulfillment of every wish almost at the touch of a button. And yet, as in so many fairy tales, when the wishes finally materialize, they're like fairy gold. They're not really material at all. In other words, so many of our products, our cars, our homes, our clothing, our food, it looks as if it were really the instant creation of pure thought. That is to say, it's thoroughly insubstantial, lacking in what the connoisseur of wine calls body. And in so many other ways, the riches that we produce are ephemeral. And as a result of that, we're frustrated. We're terribly frustrated. We feel that the only thing is to go on getting more and more. And as a result of that, the whole landscape begins to look like the nursery of a spoiled child who's got too many toys and is bored with them and throws them away as fast as he gets them, plays them for a few minutes. Also, we're dedicated to a tremendous war on the basic material dimensions of time and space. We want to obliterate their limitations. We want to get everything done as fast as possible. We want to convert the rhythms and the skills of work into cash, which indeed you can buy something with, but you can't eat it. And then rush home to get away from work and begin the real business of life, to enjoy ourselves. You know, for the vast majority of American families, what seems to be the real point of life, what you rush home to get to, is to watch an electronic reproduction of life. You can't touch it. It doesn't smell, and it has no taste. You might think that people getting home to the real point of life in a robust material culture would go home to a colossal banquet or an orgy of lovemaking or a riot of music and dancing. But nothing of the kind. It turns out to be this purely passive, contemplation of a twittering screen. You see, mile after mile of darkened houses with that little electronic screen flickering in the room. Everybody isolated, watching this thing. And thus in no real communion with each other at all. And this isolation of people into a private world of their own is really the creation of a mindless crowd. And so, we don't get with each other, except for public expressions of getting rid of our hostility, like football or prize fighting. And even in the spectacles one sees on this television, it's perfectly proper to exhibit people slugging and slaying each other, but oh dear no, not people loving each other, except in a rather restrained way. One can only draw the conclusion that the assumption underlying this is that expressions of physical love are far more dangerous than expressions of physical hatred. And it seems to me that a culture that has that sort of assumption is basically crazy and devoted, unintentionally indeed, but nevertheless in fact devoted, not to survival, but to the actual destruction of life.
And that was Alan Watts. I want to, I have not time to do both, The Failure of American Left by Norman Pollack. I'll save that for tomorrow. I thought you would find this an interesting piece because this is not the kind of thing that you will hear in any of the alternative media, which also is very pro-pharma and pro-medicine. We all need to wake up to real medicine. Please listen in.
A father of five says his life has been ruined by
a single vaccination. For the last 100 years in the United States, the medical theater has been completely monopolized and controlled by the MDs and the pharmaceutical companies. The only medicine that you're taught about in school is MD-directed medicine. The only medicine that your insurance pays for is MD-directed medicine. The only medicine that's practiced in your hospitals is MD-directed medicine, and certainly the only medicine they make TV shows about is MD-directed medicine. But MD-directed medicine is just one small piece of the greater pie of medical science. And yet, because the MDs have monopolized the medical theater in this country for 100 years, we equate medicine with MD. And we don't know that there's another way. We don't know that there actually do exist science-based, clinically verified, safe and effective alternatives to MD treatments delivered by licensed physicians, and they're due. But we're not aware of this in the United States because of 100 years of pharmaceutical company propaganda. And here's how it breaks down. While the MDs have been driving the bus of medicine in the United States, the leading cause of death in the United States is MD-directed medicine. You can source this information at the front page of my website. There's an article called Death by Medicine. It is a 45-page long, extremely well-referenced document. It draws data from the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Lancet, and a number of other very prestigious medical journals. The way that the numbers go, the leading cause of death, 780,000 people a year killed by MD-directed medical treatments. The second leading cause of death, heart disease. 699,000 people a year killed by heart disease. The third leading cause of death, cancer. 550,000 people a year die from cancer. And when I read an obituary and I see that somebody's died from cancer, when I read an obituary and I see that somebody's died from heart disease or from the complications of a simple medical procedure, you know what I think? I think medical failure. But most people give the MDs a pass when they fail because we don't know that there's another way. Because they have monopolized the medical industry, when their therapeutics fail us, when their therapeutics harm us, or even when their therapeutics kill us, we give them a pass. Because we don't know there's another way. You don't know what you don't know. And when it comes to health, the stuff that you don't know will kill you or will heal you. It's like the movie The Matrix. We are all deeply embedded in the matrix of the myth that the MD is the king of medicine and that the therapeutics delivered by the MD are the only valid medical therapeutics. This is why we let them continue to hurt us. This is why when their therapeutics fail us, we give them a pass. We have thrown $1 trillion of money into cancer research. Who have we given it to? The acupuncturists, the chiropractors, the naturopaths, the homeopaths, the Ayurvedic medical practitioners, the traditional Chinese medical practitioners? No. We have given it to the MDs exclusively, and they have failed us. After $1 trillion of research money, cancer rates have remained unchanged. After $25 billion of cholesterol-lowering statin drugs a year, the heart disease rates are unchanged. And yet, while we let the MDs direct our health care, arthritis increases, high blood pressure increases, fibromyalgia increases.
And you can hear the rest of that on our website. It's a longer piece, but it explores this in some depth. Now I'm going to conclude today's program with a part of Norman Pollack's article called A Failure of the American Left, Iron-Fisted Co-optation. Quote, this week I was a guest on Gary Noll's program, preceded by Chris Hedges, a solid analyst and critic of contemporary social order, to discuss the failure of American radicalism to act as a transformative political, ideological, social force in opposition to repression at home and intervention abroad. As usual, Gary's questions prodded interviewees through his penetrating insights to launch into orbit with many monologues on the given topic, and Chris was superb in his portion, focused on Woodrow Wilson's administration, its pursuit of repayment for Morgan and other bankers' loans to European nations, threatened by German victory as reason for intervention, its Krill Committee, a steady propaganda to control public opinion, and of course its suppression of radicals, notably the Wobblies, as the genesis for modern-day U.S. anti-radicalism. This is persuasive, but doesn't go far enough either on Wilson or on America. Hence, I want to contribute the following. Let me here sketch out a more long-term analysis of the problem, not in criticism of Chris, for whom surviving radicalism is in debt for whatever life it still remains, but merely as a further take on the situation of America's declining left. First, one must enlarge the historical context. Wilson simply was the person who was pivotal in the steps to the societal process of curbing and seeking to eliminate radicalism as having legitimacy in what, after all, had been the continuity of American capitalist development from the late 18th century through the present, which has narrowed the boundaries of structural and social change, stifling the rise of alternative formations such as socialism or more humane political culture and systems of value. This is not a deterministic formulation, but only points up the conscious functioning and furtherance of class dynamics by which ruling groups have taken control through the normalization of capitalist fundamentals of wealth and power accumulation in a hierarchical framework. Exploitation plays a significant role. So does market economy. So does the constitutional, legal, and ideological protections of the property right. So does the suppression of labor violence. So does commercial penetration increasingly taking on global dimensions. So does the military factor, whether as the spirit of militarism, naval power in action, intervention in ensuring the realization of a closed, one-track pattern of growing with conformity and dismissive of all systems, beliefs, people who challenge the moral rightness of what they do. For better or worse, and I obviously think the latter, America is locked into a capitalist order, admitting no deviation from government servitude to its need for security and expansion. The state invariably, the handmaiden of business in its myriad forms and undertakings. Liberalism from the start encapsulates the capitalist worldview as C.B. McPherson brought out in his seminal work, The Political Theory of Possessive Individualism, in which proprietorship of the self becomes the primal act of owning, then extended to all things, ownership next to God in the ranking of splendor. And as Lewis Hartz also brought out in his book, The Liberal Tradition in America, in which he urges that America never had a feudal past, that instead it was born mature, a capitalist system from its inception, having puritist capitalist institutions of property, which separated it from the pre-modern structures of ethos of 17th century Europe. To be born capitalist as a nation becomes a decided historical advantage in keeping the lid on and in any circumscribing and circumventing radicalism, placing the burden of proof for social change in the democratic process on the dissenter, the protester, the radical. And so it is. Even the political economy of American slavery, the seeming exception to the central focus on capitalist institutions, as rather instead exemplifying pre-modern or semi-feudal institutions, turns out to be eminently capitalistic from the standpoint of investments, markets, and profits. If still not on a plane with industry and agriculture in the North, but that per se is reason enough for fighting the Civil War, thanks to Charles Beard, as working towards a more unified capitalist system of production and exchange, with the commensurate infusion of racism throughout the nation, the fuller popularization of exploitation, and the confirmed supremacy of the national government, free now to address the needs and problems of the business civilization. The Civil War now opens, not to close as a chapter in the continuous stabilization, concentration, and expansion of American capitalism, with the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, a preview of labor suppression to follow, the Haymarket Affair of 1886, adding radicals and radicalism to the list of undesirables, and the Pullman Strike, the lockout of 1894, all as highlights attempting to snuff out the lights of radicalism. Labor is by no means totally beaten down as the 20th century began, but from from Teddy Roosevelt through Hoover, Wilson, a standout performer, it has taken its licks, withdrawn more into self, typified by Gomper's leadership of class accommodation, not class struggle, and seeking, as in the building trades, a respectability akin to 100% Americanism, nullifying its radical potential in the process. So, and you can read the rest. What is he saying here? He's saying that even today, our entire civilization, as we live it, no matter what your religion, no matter where you're at in that class structure, we abhor, we disdain, we're fearful of anything that is considered radical. But the capitalist system doesn't accept or tolerate anything radical, accepts nothing that can challenge it. So it maintains total authority, total control, and it controls the media, it controls the government and its agencies, it controls the dialogue, it controls who makes the laws and what those laws represent. And now, just free speech against a policy, you can be considered a domestic terrorist. So that's how successful they've been. To have even a thought that challenges anything in the corporate world is to be considered too radical to be appeased. You must be put down, arrested, harassed, or in some way neutralized. That's what Pollack was saying. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.